Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 8th canto, 3rd chapter, text number 4. Yasvatmanidam ninjamaya yarpitam. Yasvatmanidam nijamaya yarpitam. Kvachit vibhatam kvachatat tirohitam. Kvachit vibhatam kvachatat tirohitam. Aviradrik sakshya yubhayam tarikshate. Aviradrik sakshyubhayam tarikshate. Sa atmamulo vatu mam parat para. Sa atma mulo vatu mam parat para. Yasvat manidam nijamaya yarpitam. Kvachit vibhatam kvachit atirohitam. Aviradrik sakshyubhayam tarikshate. Sa atmamulo vatu mam parat para. Others? Vaishnavis. Yah, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who? Swa-atmani, in him. Idam, this cosmic manifestation. Nijamaya, by his own potency. Arpitam, invested. Kvachit, sometimes at the beginning of at the beginning of a kalpa. Vaibhatam, it is manifested. Kvacha, sometimes during dissolution. Tat, that manifestation. Tirohitam, not visible. Aved Edrik. He sees everything in all circumstances. Sakshi, the witness. Ubayam, both manifestation and annihilation. Tadikshate, sees everything without loss of sight. Sa, that Supreme Personality of Godhead. Atmamula, self-sufficient, having no other cause. Avatu, please give protection. Mam, unto me. Parapara, he is transcendental to transcendental, or above all transcendence. Translation. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, by expanding his own energy, keeps this cosmic manifestation visible, and again, sometimes renders it invisible. He is both the supreme cause and the supreme result, and the observer and the witness in all circumstances. Thus, he is transcendental to everything. May that Supreme Personality of Godhead give me protection. Purport. The Supreme Personality of Godhead has multipotencies, parasya shaktir vividhai vishriyate. Therefore, as soon as he likes, he uses one of his potencies, and by that expansion, he creates this cosmic manifestation. Again, when the cosmic manifestation is annihilated, it rests in him. Nonetheless, he is infallibly the supreme observer. Under any circumstances, the Supreme Lord is changeless. He is simply a witness and is aloof from all creation and annihilation. Om Aginatam Anandasha Jananjana Shalakaya Chakshuran Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam. So, well, that's the first time I ever heard that one. Transcendental to the transcendental. That's pretty. Krishna is transcendental to the transcendental. Or in other words, he's even above transcendence. So, so Prabhupada here in the purport is saying that therefore, as soon as Krishna likes, he uses one of his potencies, and by that expansion, he creates this cosmic manifestation. So, but we should understand clearly that this is referring to the material world, not the material world. When we hear the phrase cosmic manifestation, that's referring to the material world. Krishna's spiritual abode is eternal. It doesn't come into being. It's like Krishna. It's eternal. I think there's that verse in the first canto, first chapter, first verse of the Bhagavatam. Damna svena sada nirastakuakam sacham param dimahi. It's eternal abode. It's like Krishna. So this is referring to the material creation. And, you know, Prabhupada's giving us a very succinct, concise statement here of the basic principle of how it all comes about. Krishna wants it to come about. He says, as soon as he likes, he uses one of his potencies, and that by that expansion, he creates this cosmic manifestation. In the Bhagavad Gita, there's a purport where Prabhupada says, we may think of doing something, but sometimes there are impediments, and it's not always possible for us to do what we like. But when Krishna wants to do something, simply by his willing, everything happens so perfectly that one cannot even imagine how it is being done. So that's Krishna. I think there's a name for Krishna that to that effect, such a sankalpa, that just when he wants something, when he desires something to happen, it happens. You know, nobody else is in that category. Krishna's will is itself actual fact. So the Bhagavatam is giving us like a bird's eye view of how things happen. You know, the bird's eye view means, you know, you're getting it from the perspective of the bird. You know, bird's eye, let's analyze that expression, bird's eye view. The bird is up. Just like in warfare, they always say, seize the high ground. Because if you seize the high ground, you can see what's going on, and you know how where the enemy's coming from, how to attack and everything. So the bird's eye view means, you know, at a better vantage point, from a perspective that gives you, you know, a bigger picture. So the Bhagavatam is giving us that because, and we need it because we are generally seeing things, especially people who aren't devotees, are seeing things from a grub's eye view. A grub is like a little insect that crawls along the ground. It's very small. It's kind of like, you know, what kind of, you know, if you're seeing things from a grub's eye view, there's not much you can understand. But generally, we're seeing things from a grub's eye view. And therefore, this is kind of like quite mind-boggling information, because generally, you know, we don't think, generally the average person, the average Joe on the street doesn't tend to think of that this is how the cosmic manifestation came about, you know. But for instance, you ever heard that expression, humble beginning? Yeah, humble beginning means like, you know, things start off kind of small and simple and, you know, not very complex and like that. And there's a reason why that expression is there, because that's our experience. We generally tend to experience things that way. Things start off small, like when a person is born, they don't start off like, you know, like when they're full of strength and body. You start off like a little infant, you know, and you grow and you develop into a full human being like that. And even things, human products, you know, like say the buildings. We're in a building right now. Well, look at buildings. Buildings, they start off like, historically speaking, you know, at least this is the information we get if you get a Western education, that buildings start off simple. There was like huts. First people, you know, got together, straw and mud huts, and they maybe learned how to use the trees to build log cabins, and then they kind of, somebody figured out you could pile stones upon each other and make, you know, and then somebody found and discovered steel, and, you know, it's a progression, right? Things start off like a humble beginning, you know. Cars, it was first people used to ride around on animals, and then they figured somebody invented the wheel, supposedly, and then they put a cart behind the animal, and the animal would pull the cart, and then you have the horseless carriage, you know, see? So humble beginning, and things develop. So people tend to think, that's our experience, and we tend to think of, like, even life and the whole world, you know, developing along those lines. Maybe that's a reason why evolution became such a, you know, it was easily accepted and is an easy thing for people to wrap their minds around, because it does sort of match in some way our ordinary experience. You know, things start from the simple and the small and develop, you know, into something bigger and greater and better like that. And and actually, and that's the way we tend to think in Krishna consciousness, right? Wrong. Wrong. We don't. In Krishna consciousness, we actually, the amazing thing, Krishna consciousness, we start from practically the opposite end of the spectrum. In Krishna consciousness, we don't say that things start from a humble beginning. We have just the opposite idea. Our idea is that things start off from the most spectacular, stupendous, colossal, amazing, magnificent, and wonderful. Krishna. Where's Amala Bhakta? I need some more adjectives. He's adjectives personified, but he's not here to help us. But anyway, yeah, things start off from this, the most, like I just said, spectacular, stupendous, colossal. Krishna. Everything starting from Krishna, not from some humble beginning. Krishna's like the complete opposite of humble beginning. And and it's even like, say, somebody could say, oh, so, you know, a non-devotee might say, them response, oh, so you think, so you're saying that Krishna is first. No, we're not. We're saying Krishna is before, sorry. We're saying Krishna is even before first. That's how far out Krishna is. Krishna is even before first. Because if you say such and such came first, well, what came before first? You see, Krishna is the first being. Does that mean there was no being before Krishna? No, it's not even correct to say that. It's not even correct to say that Krishna is the first being, because that's implying that there was no being before Krishna. But there was never a time when Krishna did not exist. So it's not even correct to say that. You have to say Krishna is eternal. That's more accurate. And the Brahma Samhita kind of, and that is the Vedic understanding, that Krishna is eternal. He's not even the first. He's before the first. In the Brahma Samhita it says, Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchidananda Vigraha Anadir Adir Govinda, which means that Krishna is the origin of everything and he has no origin. Right? Krishna is the origin of everything and he has no origin. Now put that in your sweet rice and drink it. That's really amazing thing. And then in case somebody was going to try to semantically wiggle out of that, the next line in the in that verse in the Brahma Samhita is Sarva Karana Karanam. You know, just in case they were going to try to, somebody's going to try to wiggle out, well, he may be the origin of everything and he has no origin, but, you know, then he just created everything and he stepped back from it and, you know, things are going on. No, he's Sarva Karana Karanam. He's also the cause of all causes. You know, And just in case, you know, you're interested, he's Ishvara Parama, he's the Parama Krishna, he's the a supreme controller as well. So anyway, so this is the Vedic idea that what to speak of, you know, things starting from a humble beginning, they start from the most, they don't even start. it's hard to actually describe the situation because, you know, it's like human language really doesn't accommodate, ideally, describing Krishna. Because Krishna is, you know, human language is a byproduct of our intelligence, our experience of life. You know, we experience life in a certain way, and then we tend to express things in a certain way. But Krishna's beyond that experience. For instance, we experience everything within time and space. Is Krishna within time and space? No, time and space is within Krishna. Time and space are Krishna's energies. We're within time and space, you know, so we have to express everything with a beginning and an end, but Krishna's beyond, that's within Krishna. So that's why it's hard to even really get a handle. I mean, you can with human language, you can conceive about Krishna, but you can't comprehend. There's a difference between comprehending is when you really understand. Conceiving means you can get some idea, some conception, right? But to comprehend, that can't be done. Human language falls short. It fails miserably, you know. The only way to comprehend these things is you got to surrender and they have to be revealed to you. Like a non-devotee's response to this is, no, forget it. This can't. It's not true. And a devotee's response to it, at least unless the person is a devotee, a Mahabhagava from past lives, the average devotee's response to it is, okay, might be true, so what's the program? What's the deal? Well, you got to engage in devotional service. You got to chant Hare Krishna. You got to follow the regular principles, et cetera, et cetera. So to get purified, atak Shri Krishna Namani, Nabhaved Gurai Mindriye, then Sevan Mukhehi Jivado, Svayam Avis Padate. That when you engage in devotional service, you know, beginning with the tongue, then Krishna eventually will reveal himself to you. There's so many different verses that say that same thing in so many different ways. But that's how you comprehend Krishna. We have to engage favorably in devotional service. And then tesham, how's it go? tesham satadiyuktanam bhajatam priti porvakam dadami buddhi yogam tam yenam ampupyante tesham eva anukam partam aham agyana jam tamaha nasyami ambabhavashto gyana dipena bhashvata. Krishna says, first he says, to those who are constantly devoted and worship me with love, I give them the intelligence by which they can come to me. Notice he gives people enough intelligence to know, hey, I got to engage in devotional service favorably. And then he says, to those who are constantly, out of compassion, this is what happens when you do that. After you do that, out of compassion for them, Krishna says, I, who am dwelling within everyone's heart, destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. Notice Krishna enlightens you. Krishna, out of his causeless mercy, he allows you to understand what the real deal is, who you really are, that we're not, this is just an illusion. We're not this material body, and we're not the subtle body in this material body either. That's not us either, you know. We're like an eternal servant of Krishna. We have like a spiritual identity, a spiritual psychology. We have a relationship with Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that has nothing to do necessarily, what to speak of this gross body, even has nothing to do with the subtle body, which is we're stuck with this whole time we're in the material world. So anyway, that's how we comprehend Krishna, by engaging in devotional service, and then by his causeless mercy, when Krishna is good and ready, he can just, I can't remember the Sanskrit, but he can just pull away that deluding curtain of Maya and allow us to understand who we really are, who he is, and what our relationship is with him. So, but the attempt of the mundane materialist to understand Krishna, you know, using the gross material senses, like that mind and senses, it's like the attempt of a small insect trying to understand a human being. You know, you might be some small insect, and the human being is coming to either destroy it. Some, you know, human beings will destroy small insects. Or you might just want to get it out of you. Like say there's some small insect in the temple room. Devotees, we won't kill it. We'll just take a piece of paper or something, slide it under it, and put it outside the door. So what can that small insect understand about us? The only thing it can possibly maybe understand is, hey, I'm being moved. I'm being moved by something that I don't know what it is, but it's a lot bigger and greater than me. But, you know, do you think it knows anything about, like, our philosophy? Or it's our attempt to understand Krishna with these, you know, the gross material mind, the senses is like that. it's got to be, you know, inadequate. It's got to be, you know, a failure. It was so small and insignificant. So, which brings us to think, so if we're so small and insignificant, we're like little insects, why is Krishna interested in us? Well, I actually kind of already touched upon this point, that actually we are small, and we are, at least within these material bodies, insignificant. It's a very material life existence in general. It's an insignificant affair in one sense. But we are, you know, we are significant in a spiritual sense because we're Krishna's parts and parcels. You know, as I mentioned previously, we're not these material bodies, and we're not the subtle body in this gross material body either. We're eternal spiritual beings. Each one of us, every single living entity has an eternal spiritual relationship with Krishna. And Krishna loves every one of his parts and parcels. Krishna actually, every single part and parcel is important to Krishna, and Krishna loves every part and parcel. And the proof of that is that even though we screwed up horribly, and as a result of that, we've had to wind up here in this material world, you know, Krishna doesn't allow somebody he loves to come here to this material world. Must, you know, there had to be a good reason for that. So anyway, we screwed up horribly, we wound up here in this material world, but Krishna loves us so much that he's always trying to get us out of this material world, right? And a further proof of that is how much he loves each one of us, is that Krishna is prepared to allow us to go back to Godhead even if we just engage in devotional service properly for one short human lifetime. You know, in the last class I gave, I was mentioning about the lifetime, the comparison, comparing the human lifetime to the lifetime of the demigods. The demigods, the major demigods like Indra, Chandra, Varuna, et cetera, they live for 300 million years, you know. So that means we live for 100 years, let's say. We don't, but let's say we do, okay. So they're living for 3 million times what we live. You know, if you work that, the ratio out, like that's like 1 second to, I don't know how many days, months, or years. You know, it's like nothing. Our lifetime is nothing. And even the demigod's lifetime is nothing in relation to Lord Brahma's lifetime. He lives for 311 trillion years. And his old lifetime, according to the Bhagavatam, is like one nimesha, which means a half a second to Mahavishnu. So, you know, it's like, it's really amazing that in one short human lifetime, if we just play our cards right, you know, if we just surrender and engage favorably in devotional service, we can go back to Godhead. Actually, good idea to meditate on that a little bit every now and then. The demigods are, and in the fifth canto, there's this verse, I can't remember the Sanskrit, but the gist of it is that the demigods, they're aware of this, our situation here, of our good fortune. And they're actually praying. They're praying that, oh, please let me take birth as a human being on Bhart Varsha, you know, during that period when Lord Chaitanya Sankirtan movement is going on, so that I can engage in devotional service and in one short lifetime go back home, back to Godhead. So it's, you know, it's an amazing opportunity. And, so we really have to surrender, and that's the essence of the whole thing. That's the whole name of the game, just surrender to Krishna. Surrender means making the choice, the decision to we have to voluntarily be willing to live in submission or compliance to the will of Krishna. The will of Krishna is understood by the instructions of the spiritual master. The instructions of the spiritual master, that's the will of Krishna. If you want to, somebody might say, well, what's the will of Krishna? It's real easy to understand. It's the instructions of the spiritual master. You say, what Prabhupada says you should do, that's the will of Krishna. See, so we just have to be willing to, you know, to go accept what Prabhupada has said, and then we're okay. And that's the essence of the whole thing. What's the time? Okay, I'll just go a little longer then. So, I told this story before, but I'll just give the short version now. on this point of, like, you know, surrendering, I used to go for japa walks up to the Kenneth Hahn Park. You know, I stopped. Now I'm doing my japa walk here in the temple room. It's better. But when I was younger and foolisher, that's what I was doing. So anyway, so one morning, this was a Sunday morning, I was on my way back. And I went all the way up to the top of the Kenneth Hahn Park, and I was kind of coming back. And there's only one spot, kind of worked the walk out, so there's only one place where I had to, you know, have a light. And that was at the intersection of La Cienega and Rodeo, however you say it. So there I was on my way back, and the light was against me. It was a red light. So I stopped. But, you know, this is like it's 6:30 in the morning because I used to get back for greeting the deities. So 6:30 in the morning, and, you know, I want to make back on time for greeting the deities. And there's that red light in front of me on Sunday morning, which is the quietest morning of the week. So I look around. I look down La Cienega to the east and the west, or whatever it runs, north and south. And then I look down Rodeo in front of me, and I didn't see any cars. There's not a car in sight. And I kind of look, you know, like that, and I look behind me, and I didn't see a car. So I thought, okay, Sunday morning, nobody's around, you know. It's a red light, but let me cross. So I started to cross. And I was in the street, and, you know, but no sooner did I get in the street and take a two or three steps, I hear, like, you know, all of a sudden I see these, like, flashing red and blue lights, and just I hear, yeah, yeah. And a car comes around the corner, right from behind me a car comes, and I'm looking, I said, oh, no, it's a police car. And, you know, I'm walking in my devotional clothes. I didn't have any ID. You know, and I said, oh, no, this is what a bummer. And he pulled right around. You know, he pulled right around in such a way that not that the back of the car was facing me, but the front of the car. So he did like a whole 360. And he pulled right around right in front of me. And he said, over his loudspeaker thing, actually, no, he turned that off then. And then he, you know, had the window down, and he said to me, he was a person about my age. He was like 55, 60 looking, you know, period. He said, what are you doing? And I said to him, I looked around. I mean, I knew it was a red light, but I looked around, and I didn't see any cars, and so I just, you know, figured it was okay to cross. And he said, I'm a car. And I couldn't say anything, you know. So I just stood there quiet. He said, and then he just looked at me, and he went like this. He said, come on, voluntary compliance. And that was all he said. And I just stood there, so I said, okay, I figured now next he's going to ask for my license or something like that, and here we go. But he said, come on. He said, voluntary compliance. And that was it. And he just drove off, you know. And I thought, wow. I just took that as like coming from Krishna, you know. Not just the fact that I didn't get a ticket for jaywalking, which I, you know, should have got, but that, you know, I thought, wow. I was meditating. I said, that's like a lesson. Krishna's telling me something here. Because I was thinking, that is the essence of everything. The whole thing is voluntary compliance. And it was basically what he was saying to me in two words, voluntary compliance. He said, look, you know, you're not a kid. I could see you're about my age, 55, 60, whatever you are. You know, you're dressed in these robes. You're some kind of religious person. I mean, maybe he knew what Hare Krishna was. Maybe he didn't. But, you know, he wasn't a rookie. I mean, he was like a lieutenant or a captain or something on his Sunday off, and he just happened to be, I don't know what to say. But anyway, it's like he was saying to me, look, come on. If people like you aren't willing to live in voluntary compliance to the law, what kind of society are we going to have? You know, what's the quality of life going to be like? Because everybody knows that even when they teach you this, when you go for, you know, law enforcement or whatever they call it, what do they call that subject all the kids take? Not criminal justice. Criminal. They tell you that if everybody decided to be a criminal, there's no police force on the face of the earth that could keep law and order. I mean, the whole thing works because most people are law-abiding citizens for the most part. If everybody just decided, I'm going to steal any opportunity I get, I'm going to do, you know, rob people any opportunity I get or whatever, then there's no police force on earth that could, you know, keep law and order. What to speak of a nice quality of life society. You see, in order to have a nice quality of life society, people have to be willing to follow the laws of the land, voluntary compliance. And I thought to myself, that's the whole lesson Krishna is trying to teach us. That's the whole lesson is that, is Krishna is trying to say to those, the living entities that are here in this material world, hey, guys, listen, you got to live in voluntary compliance. How are we going to have a nice atmosphere in the spiritual world if the living entities, you know, you, my parts and parcels, aren't willing to live in voluntary compliance? What kind of mood can we have? What's the atmosphere going to be like? I mean, you know, what's the quality of life going to be like? You got to learn that. I want you to come back home, but you got to learn that first. You see? So that's the whole thing. You know, that's we got to learn voluntary compliance. And we should really try to learn it because you can't mess around with Krishna. You know, Krishna is... We hear all these wonderful good things about Krishna, how he's, you know, so kind and loving and everything, and it's all true. But at the same time, you know, Krishna is not in the bodily concept of life. You know, Krishna sometimes, if he wants to teach you a tough lesson, we could see. Krishna can teach some pretty tough lessons. And I'm not saying that when he does that, he's being cruel or anything like that. But, you know, we don't want to have to learn the hard way. You know, we better to just kind of like do things, when you hear them, let's learn it. We get the instructions. Let's not have to learn the hard way. Follow the instructions and avoid a lot of suffering that can be avoided. Because if we don't follow the instructions, we see that, and probably all of us have experienced too, that you suffer. You suffer when you don't follow the instructions of the spiritual master. And sometimes you can suffer a lot. And that doesn't mean that Krishna is not merciful or cruel, kind and loving. He is, but he's just doing what he has to do in order to get us to learn the lesson. It sometimes is referred to as tough love. And Krishna doesn't have any problem dishing out tough love. But we don't want to be the recipients of tough love. I'd rather be the recipients of soft love. I don't want to have to experience Krishna's tough love in the form of some, suffering that comes upon me. And because of mistakes I've made, and Krishna just figures, okay, well, I instructed this guy. I instructed him through his spiritual master. I instructed him through his god brothers and god sisters. I instructed him in so many different ways, and still he's not coming to the party. I hate to do this, but I'm going to have to give him this heavy one, and maybe he's going to learn it this way. We don't want to take it to that point. So the idea is that, I think your spiritual master once said, one has to accept the process of purification, otherwise one will be purified. In other words, let's be more voluntary the better. We don't have to, learn things through the school of hard knocks or like that. Anyway, it's probably, 8:10 by now, 8:15? Okay, I'll stop there. Does anybody have any questions or comments?
Hare Krishna Prabhu, thank you for your wonderful class. You were mentioned that Krishna, just by his will, whatever he wants is fulfilled.
Yeah.
So do the pure devotees, mm-hmm. they also have that power?
Yeah, in this sense. Pure devotee is not like a superman. Pure devotee is very, very dear to Krishna. So when the pure devotee wants something, it's Krishna has the potencies. Krishna is Parasha Shaktar, Vividha Vishruyate, Svabhavika, Gyana Bala Kriyacha. It's all Krishna's potencies, but he loves the pure devotee. He says pure devotee is like his love, beloved little child. So when the pure devotee wants something to happen, and he wants it badly enough, and of course he's well motivated and like all that. So Krishna just, at some point Krishna goes, all right, okay. And Krishna just makes it happen. And Prabhupada said like that. I can't remember the word, but I've heard like a few lectures where Prabhupada kind of makes that point in his own words. That's how it works. The devotee doesn't have to try to develop any mystic powers himself. The mystic powers are latent within the devotee, that's the understanding. Krishna does it. And Prabhupada's an example of that. Prabhupada wanted a movement. Prabhupada wanted to, because he wanted to fulfill the instruction of his spiritual master, which was to spread Krishna consciousness in the English language in the Western world. So Prabhupada just wanted it like anything. He was desiring it. He was praying. He was hoping. And Krishna was observing. And at some point, Krishna was just going, but wait a minute. But these people aren't qualified. You can't give devotional service to people like this. These are malachanas, yavanas. Actually worse. Sometimes I hear Prabhupada lecturing on tapes, he says, even the dog eaters can take to Krishna consciousness. The chandalas, the dog eaters. And a lot of times when I hear that, I think to myself, at least I wasn't a dog eater. I never ate dog. But, it just occurred to me this morning, but wait a second. Actually, probably a cow eater is worse than a dog eater. Is it? Does anybody know any Shastric statements? I would think that, a dog eater is bad. That's because it's real low quality meat. But, a cow eater would probably be worse than a dog eater. So I'm walking around thinking, at least I wasn't a dog eater, but I was worse. You see, we were worse. I ate every kind of meat that on the face of the earth, except for dog meat, which we don't do here in America. But we're the lowest. At least I'll speak for myself. I was the lowest. So Krishna's looking around. He's seeing these people. How could you? It says in the Bhagavad Gita, "Yesham tvantikatam papam, gyanam punyakarmanam, te dvandaniyam That only people who have acted, this is Krishna's version, okay? Krishna says, only people who have acted piously in this lifetime and in previous lifetimes and whose sinful activities are completely eradicated can engage in devotional service with firm determination. Okay? So where are those people? Where are those people who have acted piously in this lifetime and in previous lifetimes and whose sinful activities are completely eradicated? They don't exist in the Kali Yuga. Especially here in the Western worlds, especially here in America, they don't exist. See, so Prabhupada is desiring, the Krishna conscious movement spread, and Krishna's looking and he's going, how can I do it? Look, it's like no qualification here, you know? But Prabhupada desired that so strongly, so sincerely, that Krishna at some point twisted Krishna's arm. Krishna just said, okay. You want a movement? Okay, you're so all right, here. And he just gave the mercy. It's called causeless mercy. And Prabhupada confirmed in one morning walk that's kind of the way it worked, because it was a devotee. You can hear this. It's a morning walk conversation. He brought that verse up to Prabhupada. He quoted that verse and then he said, Prabhupada, you know, it says in the Bhagavad Gita, like I just said. And then he said, so Prabhupada, does that mean that we in our past lives, you know, engaged in pious activities? And he cut him off before he could say anymore. Prabhupada said, I have created your good fortune. See? I have created your good fortune. So, answering your question, yeah. Devotee doesn't have those mystic powers, but Krishna has them. And because the intimate relationship, then Krishna is willing to fulfill the desires of the devotee. That's actually, I think there's one verse in the Chaitanya Charitamrita where Lord Chaitanya says, it's talking about Vasudeva, that's Krishna's only business. You know, that's his main business, or what he considers the most important business, fulfilling the desires of his pure devotees. He's always trying to fulfill the desire. It's like a competition. The devotees are always trying to please Krishna. They don't want to accept any service. They just want to serve, and they don't want to accept any service. And Krishna, he doesn't want to. He just wants to serve the devotees. You know, like there's that famous story about when Rupa and Sanatana Goswami were in Vrindavan. This is way back in the early days, in the beginning. You know, they had no facility at all. And Sanatana Goswami was Rupa Goswami's older brother, and he was thinking, you know, I really like to. We're living so austerely. My brother is like my spiritual master, and we're living so like austerely. We're just sleeping under a different tree every night, and you know, it's really a hard life. I'd like to do something to just, you know, for my brother, my spiritual master, to, you know, at least give him something, you know, some comfort or something, some pleasure of something. So he was desiring like that, and then just some young girl came. And she brought this, like, a basket, you know, a whole big, like, basket of groceries and stuff, you know, ingredients. And Rupa Goswami was amazed. Oh, who are you? He said, I'm a girl in the village, you know. He said, no, I don't know, you know, which village, which part, you know, whose family? She said, I'm in that part. My mother has some festival. We have some extra ingredients, so please. Oh, okay. He said, yeah. And he was thinking, well, this is a very nice girl, very beautiful girl. So he just, okay. He didn't think anything of it. And he prepared a beautiful lunch for Sanatana Goswami. He invited his brother to come, and he prepared this beautiful lunch for Sanatana Goswami. And then Sanatana Goswami came, and, you know, they were taking prasadam together. Rupa Goswami was serving his brother, and he was taking, and he was relishing. Wow, this is wonderful. Thank you so much. This is very nice, very beautiful, you know. He said, where did you get these ingredients? And Rupa Goswami started describing to him, you know, oh, this nice, very nice girl came, young girl, very beautiful girl, very nice girl. She came with all this basket full of ingredients and everything. And he said, cool. Sanatana Goswami was also like Rupa Goswami, a little bit incredulous, you know. And he said, He said, could you describe her? He said, oh, yeah, she was very beautiful. She was effulgent. She had this like a golden effulgence. And she was, you know, like, very nice manners and very humble. And he went on and on like that. And then Sanatana Goswami said, oh, no, you've committed a great blunder. He said, that was Radharani. Oh, he said, you've taken service from Radharani. We're trying to always give service, you know, to Krishna and his associates. And you've accepted service. So like that, you know. So that it's a competition. You know, the devotees are always trying to serve, but Krishna, and they're always trying to serve like that. Anyway, that's probably all we have time. Oh, but one last question. Okay.
Some wonderful points today, and thank you so much for that. Even the question of bringing up, is Krishna first, or is he before first?
He's before first. But go ahead.
But you said, Prabhupada mentioned that transcending transcendence.
Yeah.
And you have the answer there.
transcendental to, he's transcendental to transcendence.
And if he's that, why do we even question whether he was first or before first? The answer has already been given. It's right in our class today by you.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. Prabhupada said the same thing that Purpur.
And about the other points also, beautiful points that you brought up today. I mean, it's just fantastic. I mean, ecstatic. Saying that Krishna appears even in our, in Srila Prabhupada, is the way how a father becomes the God for a child. And one should believe in that because Krishna comes to them in their father's form, the parent's form. So whatever the mother or father says to the child, Krishna makes that happen to the child. So the child believes in their parents, it does. So he gives, empowers them to that point. He doesn't make them God. To us, those parents will be ordinary people. But to the child, Krishna's there. And he appears in so many various forms. He's there. He's always there. He's proactive.
What's the last word? He's
proactive. Always. Yes. It's not as if you had to call him. In fact, as you just brought up another beautiful point, saying Radharani served Srila Rupa Goswami. Krishna serves. I mean, he wants to serve, as you said again. So he comes in these various forms by himself. He knows. I mean, he's the creator. He is the thing that makes things happen. So you don't even have... He knows what you're going to ask him. I mean, transcending transcendence.
Yeah, Krishna's always trying to... I'll tell you one little last anecdote, and I promise that'll be it. I'll end, okay. Before I was a devotee, I had a bunch of jobs. I got fired off all of them. But one of the jobs I had was I was a male nurse's aide in a hospital. I had an uncle who was a doctor. And so he got me a job at the Parkchester General Hospital, which is, I lived in Parkchester in the Bronx. And I was a male nurse's aide. And one of the things I have to do, the duties I have to perform is I have to get the people in and out of bed. I have to get them out of the bed and into a chair. Because, you can't stay. Like Mother Manjari did an amazing thing. She stayed in the bed for 13 days, maybe longer, 15. I can't remember how many days it was, in one position, and without eating and without drinking. I don't know how she did that. Because all the people I was in touch with when I was doing that job, after a few hours of being in a bed, they would start groaning. They'd say, oh, get me out of this bed. You'd have to move them. They couldn't stay in one position like that. So my job was to get them out of the bed and put them in a chair. And then when they couldn't sit in the chair anymore, get them out of the chair and put them back in the bed. But the amazing thing was, even though despite the fact that they were groaning and complaining about how uncomfortable it was being in the bed, being in the chair, when I came to get them out, the first thing they, and I was 18 years old and I wasn't skinny like this at the time. I was kind of like, I used to play a lot of sports and do stuff. I was strong, It was obvious I could handle it. I could do it. But the first thing they would do is, say they were in the bed had these railings, and they would just grab onto the railings for dear life, But it was kind of contradicting. So on the one hand, they were going, oh, please, get me out of this bed. Get me out of this bed. But then when I came to get them out of the bed, I'd grab them from under the arms. And they just grab onto the rail. No, you're not moving me an inch. So what's going on, Well, I'm trying to help you. I'm trying to do what you asked me to do, So we're like that. And so we're praying, Krishna, please help me, get me out of this material world. But at the same time, we're holding on to these material attachments. We've got to let go, And that particular anecdote, what happened was I had to call the nurse whose aide I was, and I was pulling, and he had to pry open their hands, That's the only way we got him out. So anyway, we just have to voluntarily, you have to try to pray to Krishna, help me let go. Help me just let go of these material attachments so that you can do what you're trying to do, which is just yank me out of this material world and take me back home, back to Godhead. Grantra Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.